Pues Anthony Loach es profesor emérito en la Universidad de St Andrews en Escocia. Se define él mismo como un especialista en sociolingüística histórica con la historia del francés como terreno de aplicación. Para los especialistas del francés es muy famoso por sus estudios sobre los textos medievales del centro de Francia, pero sobre todo por su libro en los años 97 sobre la emergencia del francés. Además de un título muy llamativo, ofrece un primer capítulo teórico y metodológico sobre la escritura de la historia de la lengua, que son páginas imprescindibles en nuestra disciplina. Le paso rápidamente la palabra a Anthony Loach.
So, thanks very much indeed. It's a great pleasure. Can you all hear me? Is that audible? Good. Could I say that you need a handout because I've not brought any PowerPoint equipment, so the handout is essential, I would say. Well, thanks very much for the invitation to come here. It's a wonderful discovery for both me and my wife. It's a really wonderful place. Well, for some time now, linguists working in the field of English have been looking at what they call language myths. And initially, they use the word myth in the layman's sense of popular misconception. And that's what you can see on handout one. These are some of the myths, the language myths, or the popular misconceptions about language which circulate widely in English. Bauer and Trudgill, when they put that book together, were not breaking new ground. In French, Marina Yagello, 10 years before, had produced her marvelous little catalogue des idées reçues sur la langue. And since then, however, sociolinguists have taken up this idea, but have been taking it much more seriously. Because what they suspect is that there's something more to silly ideas about language entertained by non-linguists, that language myths have a significant effect on the way speakers use the language on a day-to-day basis. And in France, this sort of investigation has been pursued very usefully by Anne-Marie Houdbine under the guise of imaginaire linguistique, that these language myths form part of our imaginaire linguistique. Now, in a book recently published in the UK, Language Myths and the History of English, Richard Watts uses the term language myth in a more technical sense. A language mythology, as you can see on example two of the sheet, a language mythology is a nexus of shared assumptions about what a language is, whose factual status is not established, but which are prevalent and support and reinforce each other. In the context of English, Watts maintains that language myths of this type have a grip not only on the minds of ordinary speakers of English, but also on the minds of linguists themselves, and in particular, linguists writing the history of English. And you can see what he's maintaining here, that these language myths are present, and he's rather despairing about our ability as linguists to dispel these myths, that you can tell people that these ideas they're holding about language are entirely non-factual, but they are deeply ingrained and won't go away. But he devotes this book, his latest book, to seeing how these language myths have informed the history of the English language. He wasn't concerned with the full range of language myths circulating in Europe. He wasn't concerned in this book with foundation myths or with myths associated with the origins of language that we were talking about this morning. His main concern in his 2012 book was to deconstruct, à la Foucault, the canonical histories of English and to reveal the prescriptivism implicit in their purportedly descriptive treatment of historical data. In his analysis of the myths present in histories of English, Watts posits an underlying language myth, which he claims is universal across languages, which he refers to as the myth of linguistic homogeneity. The ideal language is a homogeneous language, a pure language, a language free from internal variation and change and from the corrupting influence of other languages. This master myth acts as an umbrella for a host of secondary myths which dictate the way speakers evaluate and hierarchize different types of language. So in handout three, we could see Watts' table chronologically indicating how he sees the prevalence of the main myths in his hypothesis. Three myths are of particular importance: the myth of language perfection and language superiority, the myth of the undesirability of change and the golden age, and then the myth of ethnicity, of language and ethnicity and language and nationhood. In Watts' analysis of the language myths current in the historiography of English, it seems to me there's one myth which he doesn't include, and which perhaps we specialists in Romance languages would like to see included. This would seem to me to be the myth of Latin, or la superstition du latin in some cases. In all the cultures of Western Europe, the archetypical language, which for 2,000 years has had a conditioning influence on all our thinking about languages, has been Latin. In medieval France, this belief was so strong that the word Latin could be used as a synonym for language itself, as you could see in quotation number four. Perhaps then one could add to Watts' notion of language myths another master myth, which is the myth of Latin. Latin as the homogeneous language par excellence, immune to contamination, variation, and change. Latin as inherently superior to all the European vernaculars. Latin as quintessentially the language of writing, the language of revealed truth, the language of the law. In early modern Europe, then, in order to become real languages, the emergent languages' vernaculars had to take on the characteristics of Latin. Well, Latin myths may exist simply and innocently to help speakers make sense of linguistic phenomena. But Watts argues that the rise of standard languages in early modern Europe, with the rise of standard languages, certain of these myths hardened into language ideology. That is, a system of prescriptions designed to promote and to perpetuate the social order. In the 19th and 20th centuries, the spread of standard languages at the expense of other regional and social varieties was not a spontaneous occurrence. It was promoted in each country by some political agency, and the population had to be persuaded of its rationale. The spread of language, of standard languages, couldn't happen without ideological support. Watt's book, therefore, attempts to show how standard ideology, based on nothing more than myths, these myths which he's identified, standard ideology not only profoundly affects the way ordinary speakers use their language, but more particularly, how standard ideology has influenced the way histories of the language, English in his case, have been written. Well, what I would like to do today is to approach the way histories of French have been written in a similar way. It seems to me that the grip of standard ideology on the history of English is nothing compared with the grip which standard ideology has on the way history of French have been written. I'll not go into why I think this is the case. All I have time to do is to illustrate how profoundly this ideology has skewed the way the history of French has traditionally been written. And I'll stick my neck out at the end and suggest that it continues to inhibit quite considerably the way histories of French are written even now. So let's look at section two. Let me say how I see the development of standard ideology in France. It would be interesting to see how this fits in with the way that ideology has grown up in other countries too. The study of linguistic prescriptivism and standard ideology in the UK was opened up by the man and wife team Jim and Leslie Milroy, particularly in their book Authority in Language. Now, in handout number five, I set out the main tenets of standard ideology as they are presented by, as they appeared in the Milroy's book. The first tenet of standard ideology, the ideal state of a language is one of uniformity. Watts, I think, correlates this with the homogeneity myth. The second tenet of standard ideology is that the standard form of the language is inherently superior to other varieties of the language. And this corresponds with Watt's superiority myth. And then the third tenet in standard ideology is that the most valid form of language, of a language, is to be found in writing. And this Watts deals with under his legitimate language myth. Well, what I thought might be interesting to do for myself was to try to trace in France how this ideology, this standard ideology, developed before I look at the histories of languages themselves. What were the stages whereby language ideology developed in France? Well, I correlate it with two big sociolinguistic developments which occurred long term between the Middle Ages and the 20th century. And the first can be correlated with Haugen's elaboration of functions during the later Middle Ages. There emerged in France an H variety possessing the properties serving the functions of which are traditionally performed by Latin. And then the second phase of my history of standard ideology would be related to the diffusion of the standard language, the imposition of this high variety across the whole speech community as the national linguistic norm. So I would start off by seeing the beginnings of standard ideology and tying it in with the state of diglossia which characterized Western Europe in the Middle Ages. In the 13th century, Latin performed the H functions in society, while the L functions were carried on in the various vernaculars. The great sociolinguistic development of the later Middle Ages, it seems to me, was leakage of function from the H language, Latin, to the vernacular. That the H and L functions in society, which had been performed in the 13th century by two languages, by the 16th century, they were performed by two varieties of the same language. Between the 13th century and the 16th century, a new H variety of French came into being. An H variety which was gradually equipped itself with lexical and syntactic tools, copied inevitably from Latin, which enabled the vernacular language to now perform the H functions in society in addition to its traditional L functions. As it did this, the new H variety needed to acquire dignity and prestige, which had traditionally been ascribed simply to Latin. People needed to be convinced that this new H language was indeed superior to the vernacular of everyday parlance. It seems to me that this is what was going on in the early stages of standard ideology, with the Dubelly in the 16th century, his Défense et Illustration de la Langue Française, was to make French illustrious, to increase the prestige of French, the new H form of French, as opposed to the lower forms and opposed to the other languages of Europe and Latin. And this process took some time, giving prestige to the new H variety. In quotation number 6, we see that many decades after Jubilee, the Académie Française was giving itself this mission to make French the equal, or even perhaps be better than Latin, a greater perfection than these languages. The hierarchization of the H and the L varieties of French inevitably acquired a social dimension, and the elites appropriated the H variety as part of their culture of urbanity and politeness and honnêteté, a culture which was designed to raise that particular social elite beyond the level of the ordinary populace. And so we see another part of the mission of the Académie Française was to put social distance between the speech of the H variety and the vernacular. One of the objects of the Académie, in number 6 again, nettoyer la langue des ordures qu'elle avait contractées, ou dans la bouche du peuple, ou dans la fond du palais, and so on. So when we're looking at the work of grammarians in the 17th century, we've got to be, I think, a little bit careful to avoid teleology. This is one of the problems with Haugen's classification of standardization. It leads us into a rather teleological view of the history of the language. It seems to me that the movement of linguistic codification in French in the 17th century was not part of some long-term plan to establish the standard language across the whole population, as Haugen's scheme might lead us to think. This new H variety, the bon usage, was not, technically speaking, a standard language. There was no intention, it seems to me, of setting up this variety as a model to uniformize the population, speech of the population as a whole. It was not intended as a model for everyone to follow, quite the reverse. The standardized variety, or the variety which was codified, the idea behind it was to set apart the H variety from vernacular speech. It seems to me that a basic tenet of Renaissance and post-Renaissance culture was the rejection of the vernacular. There was no intention, however, at this stage, of eliminating the vernaculars completely. That came later on. Things changed in the second half of the 18th century when incipient industrialization required a wider market for goods and services than that offered by the local parish and the local province. A bigger economic and political unit was required, which people called la nation, or the nation. And the effectiveness of this larger economic unit required the homogenization of legal systems, the uniformization of weights and measures and money and coinage, and inevitably, standardization of language within the new enlarged market. And it was at this point, particularly in France, that standard ideology assumed its powerful political form, as we can see in quotation number 7. Quotations like, "La langue d'un peuple libre doit être une et la même pour tous." These are commonplace. One could find hundreds of quotations taking us down that same route. The ideal linguistic arrangement was one language one nation. The prime role of language in society was to promote internal cohesion of the nation and distinguishing the nation from competing nations. Variation, inherent particularly in vernacular speech, had to be suppressed. The language variety chosen to serve as a norm, once the new republic was in place, was paradoxically the H variety cultivated by the elites of the Ancien Régime to separate them off from the rest. The varieties targeted for extinction were the multifarious forms of vernacular speech spoken by the population at large. And it's within this ideological climate that a new historiographical genre comes into being in the course of the 19th century, what in French is known as the histoire de la langue. So let's now look at this new historiographical genre. We spoke about this at length this morning. One of the basic principles of linguistic science is that it's descriptive, not prescriptive. And most historians of French would subscribe to this principle. But this doesn't always prevent them from allowing latent prescriptivism to contaminate their work. The extension of the standard language, or as in French they refer to it as la langue nationale, the extension of the standard language across France required the training of a whole army of teachers to do the job. New university programs had to be devised to teach grammaire et philologie française, and a new sub-discipline developed of histoire de la langue. Is it too cynical to maintain that the raison d'être of these histoire de la langue courses was to provide historical legitimacy for the spread of the standard language across the country at the expense of the vernaculars? At all events, it looks as though this new genre was imbued with standard ideology from the beginning. Traditional histories of French, such as those produced in the tradition of Ferdinand Bruno, Albert Dauzat, Pierre Guiraud, were all standard-oriented histories. What these authors understood by le français, or la langue française, was not the whole array of varieties which we might want to call French. It was first and foremost the standard language, the H language, la norme, the metonymy, synecdoche of French equals standard French is to be found everywhere, as you can see in quotations number 8. Le français représente essentiellement le langage de la société cultivée de Paris. On bannit surtout de la langue les mots vieillis. La galanterie, la politesse, etc., véritable ligne directrice de l'évolution de la langue. What is meant by langue is simply the H variety, the standard form, if you like. The overall shape of these histories follows the model which has been described in English as the funnel-tunnel model. During the early period, until the end of the Middle Ages, historians of the language are very interested in the wide range of variation, of dialect variation, which was present in Gallo-Romance. But with the onset of standardization in the 16th, 17th centuries, their focus suddenly narrows to plotting only those changes which affect the incipient standard, the literary variety. So that coming into the, we're looking at handout number 10 over the page, Georges Tracart is talking about Parisian population, Parisian pronunciation in the 20th century, the early 20th century. Seul le parler populaire continue à palatéliser autre mesure. It's as though vernacular speech in the city, the vernacular speech of a majority of the inhabitants of the city, is somehow extravagant and somehow extraneous to his description. Aujourd'hui, la prononciation est unifiée en français. Il est dangereux de ne pas se conformer à la norme. Certain authors, like Albert Doza, devoted more space to vernacular developments. But even Doza was quick to condemn them, as we can see in handout 11. Doza is very open to discussing the argot and the wide range of varieties of French present, but un tel bouleversement de la langue, de la syntaxe, doit être énergiquement combattu. The metaphors we find in these histories are often anthropomorphic. The French language comes of age only when the standard language has been devised and codified. Ce n'est qu'au début du XVIIe siècle que la langue arrive à un point de maturité où elle sera normalisée et stabilisée par la génération classique des Balèbres et des Vosgelas. Jusqu'à cette date, elle est encore dans une enfance, dans une adolescence au cours de laquelle elle s'élabore, se construit. So, traditional histories of French then are steeped in this kind of unconscious prescriptivism. Now, in the next few quotations, I take each ingredient of the standard ideology in turn and just give little examples of how they emerge in the histories of French. Firstly, let's look at the myth of homogeneity. The ideal state of a language is one of uniformity. Language variation, language change are to be deplored. This ideal can't be realized except perhaps in spelling. So in French, l'orthographe is fetishized, isn't it, to an extraordinary degree. Spelling mistakes raise considerable anger, and proposals to modify the spelling system raise public anxiety to very high levels. A great langue de culture is internally homogeneous, contains little or no variation. It's a pure language, uncontaminated from foreign languages, and clearly demarcated from other languages. So, within this ideology, Creoles can never be real languages. They're a product of language mixing. And when Gaston Paris created the idea of Francien in the 1880s to give the nascent standard language proper historical credentials, he was careful to locate it well away from the German border where there may be some contamination from Germanic. And despite the fact that the basis of the standard language in French represents ingredients drawn from many dialects, Ferdinand Bruno was at pains to demonstrate or to emphasize the purity of Francien. Le Francien ne doit pas être considéré comme un amalgame. So languages had to be clearly differentiated, delimited from neighboring languages, and language boundaries had ideally to be coterminous with political boundaries. And the notion of dialect continuum is anathema. Franco-Provençal doesn't merit. This is the language of Lyon, of Genève, of the whole area of the southeast of France. But this language doesn't really merit serious study because it lacks homogeneity. And it's very evidently a dialect de transition. A langue de transition is self-evidently less valid than a homogeneous language. Le moyen français, always or until relatively recently, le moyen français was the poor relation of histories of the French language because it's une langue de transition. Au cours du XIVe siècle, le système linguistique se désagrège et un nouvel idiome se forme. Well, traditional historians are desperate to periodize. They're desperate for not just political boundaries or dialect boundaries around them, they're desperate to put chronological boundaries around what they're doing, desperate to periodize histories of the language. And they find it difficult to believe that language change doesn't proceed by sudden jolts from one stage to the next. They find it difficult to believe that the language change is an ongoing process which takes the form of a diachronic continuum, most of the time. Not all the time, but most of the time. Well, that's the first myth, this idea of homogeneity, which suffuses traditional approaches to the history of French. The second idea, which suffuses traditional histories of French, is the myth of inherent superiority and the notion of the universality of norms. The H variety of French is not contingent. Its preeminent position in society has nothing to do with the fact that it is used by persons of the highest status and with the greatest potential for exercising power. The H variety of French is inherently superior to competing language varieties. It is clearer, it is more logical, it is more precise than all the rest. It embodies the essential nature, the genius of the nation. Les qualités de la clarté, de la précision, de l'élégance donnaient aux Français et à l'Europe une position qu'aucune langue vivante depuis le Moyen Âge n'avait connue. The Parisian norm is not arbitrary, it's not contingent. It's like the bar of the meter in the Pavillon de Breteuil. It is based on universal reason. And of course, the quintessential manifestation of French is to be found in literature. It's worthwhile mentioning here that traditional histoire de la langue were initially taught not as part of courses in linguistics, in historical linguistics, but they were part of philology, the study of the past states of the language with a view to elucidating literary texts. And traditional history of the language therefore devote a large amount of space to changes which in reality are nothing more than changes in fashionable literary style. If you look at Charles Bruno's continuation of of Ferdinand Brunner's Histoire de la langue française in the 19th century, it is simply a history of literary fashion in the 19th century. Cohen's 1987 Histoire d'une langue closes each chapter of his periods of the history of French with extracts from literary texts. Standard ideology routinely confuses language use with language system, as you can see in the quotation, par sa netteté, son goût de l'ordre, notre langue classique, en précisant l'expression, that somehow it presents as qualities inherent in the system those qualities which they admire in the best writers' uses of the system. They confuse system and usage systematically. Von Wartburg goes on to claim that it's because the French language possessed these inherent qualities that it was able to produce such marvelous literature. And then the third ingredient in the standard ideology is this, the myth of legitimate language. During the 19th century, the standard language, or the H variety as I've been calling it, was promoted to become the sole legitimate language. And this was going on all over Europe. In all the countries of Europe, vernacular usage was systematically downgraded. Education systems set up programs of literacy to equip their population to participate more fully in the industrial economy, and the most valid form of language in this situation was to be found in writing. Vernaculars don't possess a written form, so vernaculars can't be regarded as languages at all. They should be written out of history. In French, a strict hierarchy was established between langue, dialect, and patois. And you can see the way Littré defines these three. And it's essentially on the basis of the possession of a written or literary form. Even today, it's often difficult to use the word dialect in France or in French, because people brought up in this prescriptive tradition, for them, dialect don't exist anymore. And so the term dialect refers to a non-existent entity. Well, in traditional histories of French, then, attitudes to vernacular speech are not all the same. Some authors view them with greater favor than others. And by and large, rural dialects are viewed more favorably than urban dialects. But in all of these histories, vernacular speech is just a sideshow. It's something secondary to the principal narrative, which is the development of the standard language. Traditional histories, then, are steeped in prescriptivism. And maybe that's what they were meant to be. Maybe that's why they were instituted in the first place. Maybe they were not designed to be descriptive at all. Maybe their essential role was to promote standard ideology across the Republic. Well, over the past 25 years, the crass prescriptivism which we've been looking at in these earlier generations of historians have mercifully disappeared. And greater legitimacy, greater space has been accorded to language variability. However, I'm not convinced that the incubus of standard ideology has been completely lifted. It seems to me that histories of the French language are still heavily standard-oriented. And the importance of the vernacular in the process of language change is far from being recognized. Let me just take two examples. The first one is controversial. Histories of the French language routinely open with a map of France like the one you have at the bottom of page 3. They divide the country up into Languedoc, Languedoil, and Franco-Provençal. Well, analogous north-south splits in the histories of the other big languages of Europe occur. In Italian, we have a line going across from La Spezia to Rimini. In Germany, we have the Niederdeutsch and the Hochdeutsch. And in English, if there is a boundary, and a significant one in people's eyes, it might well be the English-Scots boundary. But it seems to me that in none of these countries does that north-south divide determine linguistic historiography as profoundly as it does in French. Historians of French are, by and large, completely ignorant about what's gone on in Occitan and what goes on in Franco-Provençal. I don't want to be unjust, I'm not going to say everybody is in this category, but as soon as I mention the work I've been doing on Occitan to colleagues working on the history of French, I suddenly see glazed faces and people who really are, well, c'est pas mon domaine. Gaston Paris saw the folly of setting up abrupt internal boundaries across Gallo-Romance 130 years ago. La science nous apprend. This is quotation 16. We're over the page. La science nous apprend qu'il n'y a pas deux France, qu'aucune limite réelle ne sépare les Français du Nord de ceux du Midi, et que du bout à l'autre du sol national, nos parlers populaires étendent une vaste tapisserie dont les couleurs variées se fondent sur tous les points en nuances insensiblement dégradées. However, Gaston Paris's dialect continuum idea was immediately rejected as fiercely by linguistic nationalists in the South as by linguistic nationalists in the North. And it's never since been allowed to enter the way the history of French is conceived. A great langue nationale, le français, is a pure, homogeneous language, circumscribed by clearly delineated boundaries, which we've got on our map, dialect chains, dialect continua, seen right against the basic principles of linguistic homogeneity. In Jacques Chorin's Nouvelle Histoire de la Langue recently, he stresses in his introduction the importance of continua. He is very aware of continua, but he never questions the reality of the boundary between the Languedoc and the Languedoil. Now, it's entirely legitimate for linguists to classify for descriptive purposes the dialect material presented in the Atlas Linguistique de la France by means of isoglosses. But we mustn't forget that isoglosses are arbitrary. they don't mean very much on the ground. In, for the most part, they are ultimately methodological fictions. But the problem we have is what I think is highlighted under handout number 7. Qu'en vient-il vraiment d'ériger ces découpants postulats, donner force de vérité et d'insuffler une vie propre à ce qui n'est que le résultat d'un choix parmi d'autres, etc. That these isoglosses across the middle of France are pretty arbitrary. And one wonders how far they affected communication within the country in pre-standardization days. This Oc-Oil boundary across the dialects of Gallo-Romance is fundamental to the historiography of France, of French, but it distorts the linguistic situation in the centuries before standardization pretty badly. It rests on an old assumption that before standardization, before the French Revolution, provincial France was a backward rural society, locked in immobility, placidly awaiting the arrival of the standard language to at last allow the French people to shake off their backward ideas and travel outside their native village. This vision of a medieval or pre-standardization past seems to be so at variance with everything which medieval and early modern historians tell us. European society in the Middle Ages was anything but immobile and static. They didn't have trains, but they managed to move pretty well. Urban culture in medieval France developed, depended heavily on travel and trade. The people of Lyon, the speakers of the poor old language of Franco-Provençal, these people didn't think when they spoke that they were speaking anything other than French. To them, they were speaking French. The people of Clermont-Ferrand, which I spent a lot of time examining, spent their whole lives moving backwards and forwards across this frontier between the Languedoc and the Languedoil. For them, this boundary it was inconceivable that there might exist some sort of boundary across the country. Speakers of non-standardized languages can handle language variation very well indeed, thank you. They don't need standard languages to get along with what they're doing. It's standardization, I would argue, which has damaged very badly our tolerance of language variation and our ability to handle it. So, it seems to me that this Oc-Oil distinction falsifies the way view of the past, but it seems to me that it's not a matter of scientific fact. It's one of point of view, whether you take, you want a divided Gallo-Romance or not. But dividing Gallo-Romance into three certainly simplifies the writing of its linguistic history. But it grievously distorts the sociolinguistic realities of the pre-standardized Gallo-Romance, and I would argue that it's far from being ideologically innocent. Its ideological purpose, or its function, its effect, is to efface from history the other language of France, Occitan, and the language of Lyon and Genève. I suspect that in standard ideology, this process is what is quite commonly referred to as erasure. Erasure is a process in which ideology, in simplifying the sociolinguistic field, renders some persons or activities invisible. Facts that are inconsistent with the ideological scheme of things go unnoticed or get explained away. Well, it seems to me that maybe the time has come to abandon our standard-oriented view of the history of Gallo-Romance. Maybe we should stop explaining how people failed to understand each other across Gallo-Romance in pre-standardization days and focus more on how they managed to do it. How did people travel across France in pre-standardization days and communicate with their fellows? At this point, we might enter the domain of accommodation and coinization. But none of these are matters which ever enter histories of the French language, to my knowledge. Scratch beneath the surface of spelling and phonetics and the underlying lexical and grammatical systems of the three languages of France are pretty close, in my point of view. All three should, in my view, be brought more fully into the picture. We required a less standard-oriented, more holistic view of pre-standardized Gallo-Romance. And we've got a model in von Wartburg's Französisches Etymologisches Wörterbuch deals with the lexicon of Gallo-Romance in precisely that way. On the grammatical level, instead of more grammar de l'ancien français, maybe we ought to have something, a historical grammar of Gallo-Romance as a whole, as has been attempted by Frede on the bibliography. Well, I'm moving towards the end. One more example I thought I might quote. And this is one of my problems with histories of the French language. First one is this problem of excluding that which isn't directly related to standard French. The second thing, which I would like to talk about very briefly at the end, the role of the vernacular in language change. Modern histories of French are much more open to the diversity of French than were the traditional histories which we've looked at. However, they remain perplexed with regard to the place they are to allot in the scheme of things to the vernacular. In Choron's Nouvelle Histoire, Françoise Gadet contributes a marvellous section on changes which have occurred in the vernacular, in spoken French, over the 19th to the 20th century. But the title she gives to this section is L'émergence de l'oral, as though somehow the oral wasn't there, that it has just emerged. The spoken language is the language. Modern histories of French don't give much thought to theoretical problems of language change. There's a marvelous German history of French by Berchin and others, which does. It has a whole section at the beginning explaining the theory of language change which they are subscribing to in putting together their volume. But you never find this in French. We have to read between the lines, and we see that their attention, even of the modern historians of French, remains fixated on what happens in the standard language, a preoccupation with la langue commune and things which deviate from it. Preference continues to be given to endogenous, internal mechanisms of language change, so you don't have to have language change contaminated by internal borrowing from non-standard varieties. You can stay within the standard variety at all times. The Weinreich, Lebov, and Herzog model of language change, which has become pretty widespread and pretty standard in the way historical linguistics has developed in the Anglo-Saxon world, is completely alien. It's never quoted in any works I've read on the history of French. I didn't say that French histories have to adopt an Anglo-Saxon view of things, but at least they could take some of these ideas on board. The WH model of language change. The French language is deemed to have changed only when an innovation is accepted into la norme. And there is only one norm. The notion of a plurality of norms is a contradiction in terms. Well, what's abundantly clear is, contrary to standard ideology, that all living languages involve a plurality of norms. At the most basic level, they all require an H variety and a L variety. Sprache der Distanz and Sprache der Nähe. Standards and vernaculars are both abstractions. They're both idealizations. They both involve abstract sets of norms which pull speakers in both directions, in opposing directions. Remain and Reid differentiate social norms from community norms. Social norms are those of the standard language, which operate at the level of society in formal situations. Conformity with these norms attracts overt prestige. Community norms are those which function within smaller subgroups in society, and these are involved with, well, they will trigger what Leboff calls covert prestige. But both of these types of norms have equal validity, have equal importance in the way languages work. All speakers, even the most cultivated, are permanently pulled between these two. Change in standard languages involve a permanent dialectic between social norms and community norms, between standard and vernacular. Standard-oriented histories are like some weird anatomy which concentrates on the left-hand side of the body but ignores the right. We cannot consider a history of the standard language as a history of the language. So, I would claim, conclusion, language myths are not just silly ideas about language held by non-linguists. Language myths matter, particularly when they get hardened up into ideology. In this paper, I've tried to show how standard ideology has, in my view, skewed the historiography of French pretty badly, particularly in their belief that vernaculars shouldn't really be there, shouldn't really exist. It's now time, I feel, for a more holistic view of French, of the history of French, one which brings vernacular in all its forms, social and regional, more to the middle of the picture. A holistic approach to Gallo-Romance is, I believe, what Gaston Paris was envisaging all those decades ago. And it seems to me that, looking at the history of languages, we shouldn't be simply looking at the way a standard language evolves and is then pushed top down from the authorities, but we should also be looking at the way homogenization arises in a place like France through horizontal processes which now tend to be referred to as processes of coinization. But I think I've talked long enough. Thanks for your attention.